I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
Before we get started today, I would like to thank D'Angela Duff for becoming the latest patron of Dance Music Sex Romance. Thank you so much. And of course, thank you to everyone who's listening today, whether you're supporting on Patreon or not. I appreciate everyone taking time out of their day to listen to me blather on about Prince. So now, without further ado, let's get started with my interview with Jack Reedy. He is a writer, a music writer, who's had his work in the Chicago Reader, Pitchfork, Bandcamp, Passion of the Weiss, probably plenty of other things. And he is the author of a new collection of his writing on Prince, and it's called Electric Word Life. So I can't go like a jerk. Yellow smiley off of me, X. Like he's drinking 7-Up. Rather drink 6 razor blades. Razor blades from a paper cup. He can't understand. I said too tough. It's just that I've seen the future. Boy, it's rough. I've seen the future and it will be. I've seen the future and it works. All right, so I'm here with Jack Reedy. You just wrote a book called Electric Word Life, Essays on Prince, 2016 to 2021, and I wanted to talk about it. So thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I am very excited. This is my first book. It's a pretty small run, but I'm doing it independently. And it's like very Prince super fan territory in some ways. So I'm glad to talk to someone who's an expert when it comes to some of the subject matter. You know, some people have talked about the book. I'm like, well, listen, if you don't know a lot about Prince, blah, 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 blah. I know that's not a problem here today, so thank you.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting in between, because like the thing about, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, as a Prince super fan, it can be very insular. You know, it can be a little like you're in a cult. And I think that your book strikes a good balance between not being afraid to go deep. You know, there's an essay about Madhouse in there. There's some real deep cuts that I think wouldn't be like somebody who's not familiar with Prince. But I also think it has some hooks, and some of this comes out of stuff that you wrote for a wider audience. Is that right? Like some of this has been published previously.
Yeah, definitely. So part of the subtitle there, writing 2016 to 2021, is I wanted to collect a lot of things that I'd written for other outlets in the past 5 years. I get into this in some parts of the book, but it's sort of an interesting footnote to what my writing career amounts to be thus far, is that it pretty much dovetails with Prince dying in 2016, which right. is really unfortunate. But I've also been in so many different formats and places written about him and his music, again, for some like wider audiences. There's some pieces in here that are published in the Chicago Reader. Some that are from some blogs or some other websites, you know, and then there's some original stuff too that I was like, I don't have a place to put this because it doesn't have really a news peg that fits in with the way today's like music journalism operates, you know,
right,
unless
right.
you can tie something to an anniversary or something else really newsy, it's hard to get stuff published. So in some cases, there were some ideas I had that I was like, where can I put this? And I realized that, you know, I could combine everything I'd done up until this point and sort of see how it looks as a whole. And I think it came together pretty well, but I definitely wanted to straddle that line for, you know, people who don't know anything about Prince besides the hits to learn right. a lot from it. And then I also wanted it to appeal to people who know a lot of the deep cuts or the unreleased stuff or the, you know, individual musicians who play on different records. And hopefully everybody is able to get something out of it.
Yeah. So I asked this of everybody who is on the podcast for the first time, and I will just preface this by saying that if you read Jack's book, he says he answers this question in the book as well. But just for the purpose of the podcast, I do like to ask everybody, like, how did you get into this Prince superfan territory? You know, like what's your Prince story, I guess, your
totally.
Origin story?
Yeah. There's, you know, a whole kind of backstory, like you mentioned in one of the pieces, that's more of a personal essay that sort of gets into this. But I think, you know, this is a little bit unique, I'd say generationally, in that I got into Prince because he played the Super Bowl halftime show when I was in seventh grade, I believe.
Wow.
It was the year the Bears were competing for the title. It didn't work out. But I had never seen or heard much Prince before, besides maybe like Let's Go Crazy or Kiss on the radio occasionally. But the Super Bowl performance obviously kind of blew my mind. I remember buying Purple Rain that week, or maybe the week after, because it was like on sale on iTunes, you know, for $4.99 or whatever. Yeah. to tie into him playing the show.
Right.
And to hear this music that I was vaguely familiar with, but to then jump right into Purple Rain as a middle school kid definitely blew my mind. And from there, just sort of kept going and getting into more Prince music and the deeper cuts and keeping up with the current stuff as I got into high school and college. And in particular, once we started to get into the, you know, early teens, I guess. I don't know, what do we have a name for the last decade?
yeah, I'm not sure.
you know, keeping up with his stuff as he put it out, which was obviously, I think, most of the time, not quite up to the status of his classic period. But, you know, a few things are. And also delving deeper into his classic period the best ways that I could in a period where his stuff wasn't available online, really.
Right, right.
He was actively fighting a lot of that stuff. You know, so kind of having to go about it some old school way. You know, I feel like I kind of caught the tail end of the rumors of the extended Computer Blue remix. You know, I was like reading forum threads in like 2010 from like 1992 of like Prince fans still talking about this. And at the time he had sworn off the internet so much that he was like, I don't even know if this is real. I wonder if I can find that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So especially as the like last decade had sort of an R&B renaissance in a lot of ways. And I heard so much Prince in a lot of that music that came out of like, I don't know, probably like starting 2011. I mean, you look at Frank Ocean, Miguel, Janelle Monáe, The Weeknd to some extent. And then, you know, filtering down even to all sorts of like pop songs and bands and all kinds of things. So just seeing Prince's influence, knowing his music really well, but knowing that most people didn't, at least my age, because he was relatively inaccessible. It was just kind of like, guys, I swear there's so much Prince going on here that, you know, doesn't. You know, you might not be able to hear it right now, but it's definitely in the DNA of like this music. And so I just kind of continued being a Prince fan into 2016, which is sort of, again, kind of a pivot point where I then started writing about him and my journalism career, shall we say, started or took off or whatever. And so that's, I think, in some ways why I wanted to do this book in the first place, was there's also sort of a personal significance to me. Obviously there's a personal essay in it, but it also feels like a time capsule for me because I remember where I was writing a lot of these different pieces, you know.
Right.
I was in different apartments or working on them in different places, things like that. So yeah, I feel like I just kind of caught the tail end of his life, unfortunately, not to be too grim about it, but you know, kept up with the last decade or so of his work while it was happening, which was really great. And then ever since then have been, you know, sort of enjoying the pivot of seeing all the stuff start to come out of the vault and all the, you know, the rumors of the Purple Rain Computer Blue extended cut being true and all that stuff. So, you know, there's a bittersweet sort of silver lining to all these posthumous releases is kind of seeing the myths come true. But
yeah, it's exactly.
Obviously bittersweet, the circumstances leading to it.
Yeah, it's the 2010s is both not the greatest time to get into Prince for all of the reasons that you mentioned, you know, difficulty in accessibility and the fact that his life we didn't know at the time was coming to an end. But in some ways, it's also a great time to be into him because there's more Prince music coming out now than I don't want to necessarily say ever before. That might be, you know, that might be overstating things a bit, but it's up there. You know, we're getting a lot of music
guy all the time. But yes, it keeps on coming. And you know, I think there was in some ways it's a little bit frustrating that this is how it shook out. But I think it was a little bit vindicating when after he passed, his music became a lot more accessible. And I think all of a sudden people sort of remembered the impact of his work and started to, I think, talk about his work a lot more. I think it's unfortunate that in some ways it took his passing for that to sort of happen. You know, it's sort of like he became Elvis for a new generation a little bit. But I do think it is then it's been nice in the time since to be able to kind of poke into the nooks and crannies of some of these things, these pockets of his career where there's some, you know, side projects people might not know about or B-sides that had been forgotten for a couple decades till they came to streaming, things like that. So I really liked kind of going a couple layers deeper for people as his work has gotten more accessible and these posthumous releases have come out and things like that.
And that was one of the most exciting things for me about the book was when I was reading the advance copy that you said, I didn't dawn on me until I got to the more personal parts. And then I was like, this guy is really young. Like, and so that was exciting because, you know, I'm not super involved in the fan community. Like there's people who are much more into the fan stuff than I am. But since I started writing about Prince, I got more. This is the most involved I've ever been in any fan community. So by my standards, it's a lot. And, you know, I went to the celebration at Paisley Park in 2018 and I've been to a couple of other things. And I'm turning 37 this summer. And I feel like I'm usually one of the youngest people there, you know, so it kind of gives you it's this weird thing. Like, you know, on the one hand, I've always listened to older music. Like I got super my middle school obsession was the Beatles. So like even older than Prince, you know, so I've always felt a little bit like a man out of time anyway. But I also get this. It's almost like it makes me aware of mortality. You know, I'm just like, God, I'm the youngest person here. What's going to happen when I'm old? Like, you know, is this like, am I the last torchbearer for Prince, you know? And I think that probably has more to do with just, there's not a lot of young people who can afford going to celebration for one thing. Like those kind of things are very much for people who have gotten further into paying off their student loan debt maybe than even I have.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I'm getting a skewed sense of like the people coming together in person. That's a different group, but it was very kind of, it made me happy to see that there's people, you know, 10, 15 years younger than me who are also having these. it's like, okay, this is going to keep going. More people are going to discover this. I'm not going to be like the voice in the wilderness in the next 20 years.
Yeah, well, and I think some of my work, you know, I definitely get that sort of feeling like the spring chicken around talking to people who are Prince fans. You know, I do a lot of other music journalism that otherwise I try to stay really focused on, like newer artists that are independent, focused in Chicago typically, which is my base of operations. And I really enjoy doing some of that, like artist discovery and things like that. But, you know, on the other hand, like some of the other stuff I'm an expert in happens to be this 40-year-old body of work by Prince that happens to turn up everywhere in music. So, you know, it's fun for me to be able to kind of combine those two things where I can when you start to spot the influence. But yeah, I think it reminds me of the first story in the book, which was originally published in The Reader. It's about Prince's influence on house music, which started in Chicago in the mid-80s. And I think it turned out great as a story, if I can toot my own horn, sort of showing the way that Prince and house music sort of like intersected for a decade plus or so. But especially working on that story, I really enjoyed it because I got to talk to a bunch of pioneers and DJs and producers from this scene in Chicago that then blew up to the rest of the world in terms of the spread of house music. And what it came down to was me having several hour-long phone calls with these guys in their late 40s, early 50s, maybe a little older, talking about Prince. You know, it was like all these guys talking about, yeah, well, I was 16 years old and, you know, I really loved the sound of the drums on 1999. So we took like my kid brother's toy drum set. And we like fed that through a PA trying to like get a similar sound, just getting to geek out with people about the stuff that they were into when they were young and see how those like influences then kind of mutated and spread and things like that. I think it's really kind of satisfying to be able to trace that out. And I think part of what I like about this work, and I think especially this collection, is that there's then some threads running through each of those stories that I think you can kind of pick up on throughout the book that I just think mark history in a certain way. You know, I think if you connect Prince to Chicago house music and then you see how far Chicago house music went on top of, you know, Prince's very well-known impact, you know, I think it just sort of interlaces things together in a way that is valuable. I think historically speaking, and just in a general sense, it's good for people to know that, you know, your music can have an impact, whether you're someone like Prince or whether you're someone who's more anonymous or, you know, no matter your surroundings, that kind of story.
Right. Yeah. And that story, that is one of my favorites. And it's the first one. So this works out well. I kind of wanted to go in and talk about each of these.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So it starts with, you know, you reference Felix the House Cat's song, We All Want to Be Prince. could see even just there, this influence is spanning decades, filtering down from Prince's electronic stuff in the early 80s, like 1999, especially through these artists, and then it becomes its own tradition. And I was excited to see this because this is something my family comes from, like Detroit area. So this is something that I've been wanting to see for Prince in Detroit, but it was also about Chicago, which is something I'm less familiar with, but there's a lot of similarities between the Chicago house music that Prince influenced and the Detroit techno music that he influenced. And it's this interesting, like, pan Midwestern, but very cutting edge black music that was happening in Detroit and also in Chicago. And then, in Minneapolis, it was basically just Prince, but he was kind of taking stuff that I'm sure he heard at clubs in Detroit and Chicago and in New York, and doing his own version of it. So there's this really interesting, cross influence, because I think he heard some early house and techno, and that was also filtering into his own stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to say it's funny you bring up Detroit and the connections of techno and things like that, because I definitely want to shout out, I was double checking the author as you were going through that, but Michelangelo Matos, I've only ever seen it written down. He wrote a great article for Red Bull Academy back in 2013 about Prince's connection to dance music sort of generally, but it focuses a lot on Detroit techno, in particular because he got so much support from Mojo, the DJ in town, early on in his career. So that was a connection that he'd established. And so I remember reading that article several years before I was working on this specific house focused one. And so I've always sort of looked at my article as sort of like the B-side or the sequel to that piece, because that one's a lot more focused on Detroit techno and those connections. I can definitely send you that link. So it's out there. It's really good. And I just wanted to sort of build on that. Like you said, I think there's that sort of Midwestern unity across Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis. And I think there's definitely, I think there was more interplay than people necessarily give credit to the other genres for, right? Like everybody knows Prince is like the super genius who was doing all these new things. But I do think people then sometimes forget, like, yes, he was hearing new things and bringing those into his sound. It wasn't just a one-way situation. And yeah, there's a story that I was unfamiliar of until I started speaking to Steve Silk Hurley about this. He had written a rap for a song, I believe it was called Music is the Key.
Music is the key to set yourself free from violence, drugs, and increasing poverty. The key is to a lock, the lock is on the door. The door has a knob that you never turned before. A jackmaster jock can open up the lock because he has the key to unlock your body. Takes the lock off and opens up the door to house, house people galore. The beat won't stop with the JM jock because he jacks the box and the party rocks. The clock tick tocks and the place gets hot, and believe it or not, all your troubles you forgot. It's just that easy if you want it to be. For all the fellas and the young ladies, so ease your mind and set yourself free to the mystifying youth that we call the key.
The rap was all about like music being able to change your life, and it's the key to coming together, and just like very positive messaging. And he had included it on one of his own tracks, which was its own sort of novelty because, you know, house and hip hop were seen as pretty sort of distinct things. So, even rapping on a house track was not necessarily like a given thing to do. So he puts out this rap, I think it's in 85, and then probably a year and a half later, he hears from Cat Glover that she was going to be performing that on an upcoming Prince album.
Music is the key to set yourself free from depression, drugs, and increase of poverty. The key is still unlocked, the lock is on the door has a knob that you never turned before. The jack is the jack, it opens up the lock, because there's the key to unlock the body. Place it like that to open up the door to the house for the people galore.
And he didn't really hear much more about it besides that until the Black Album got canceled and it just kind of disappeared except for these bootleg copies. And so he makes the point that he's glad that he didn't antagonize anyone up front about them using a thing that he'd written, because the album didn't come out and he was kind of in limbo for a little bit. And, right, you know, it was sort of a nothing. until a few years later when Diamonds and Pearls is in the works and he gets a call to do a remix of Get Off. So this is my like campaign to anyone who might be listening who could pass this on to the people in charge. But if you listen to some of the remixes that are streaming, like the house style remix of Get Off, that's the Steve Silk Hurley version. Mm. I don't know why he's not like credited at this point. I feel like he should be the way like Shep Pettibone is on.
Yeah, it's a big name. Yeah,
exactly. And he's a big deal house producer. And so he was really excited to be able to work on a song for Prince and do a remix with him, especially because, you know, they'd sort of crossed paths sort of a few years prior. And so he sees that as sort of like the moral of the story being just come in with good intentions and you never know how things might come back around to you, you know, yada, yada. But I love that remix. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, it was a very clear like intersection of Prince and house, maybe more than ever before when he comes out with this big single that has these specifically house influenced remixes on them. And the, you know, beautiful thing about talking to Steve Silk Hurley about this is he says that, you know, he never talked to Prince about the rap being used, but he always likes to think that it was significant to Prince because it was true for the two of them. He talks about how music did help him, you know, sort of find his calling in life and help him turn around things for himself when he was in high school. And he says, like, you know, Prince kind of had the same thing where, like, music became his life. And I think we had that in common, you know, so. It was cool to see that, you know, someone of this caliber who's an influential musician and remixer and someone who worked with Prince and has had so much influence on music is also ultimately a Prince fan and someone who looks up to Prince. You know, it's not just as simple as all the people who love listening to Little Red Corvette on the radio. There's also these people, you know, who remember like, oh, yeah, I learned how to play that song because I loved it so much. Or I only bought the 12-inch because I couldn't afford the LP at the time. I was just had my allowance or whatever, you know.
Right.
So it was great to be able to find out some of those connections. And I learned a lot more about house in the process as well. You know, I like house music, but I didn't know that much about some of the early roots of it in Chicago until working on that story. And so it was really great to, again, sort of tie those things together and learn more about both in the process. And I really love finding an interview that Prince did specifically about Chicago with Chicago Publication. From 2012 when he was doing his United Center shows. And he talks about Chicago being a great music town and a place that his father really respected when he came to play, you know, when he was touring the country and things like that. So it was a cool note to end that story on, knowing that Prince, you know, had his own thoughts about Chicago as a city, even though Minneapolis obviously was his home base.
A couple of years ago, there was a conference that I unfortunately wasn't able to attend. It was about the Batman album. It was just a 2-day symposium about Batman. And they had Prince's engineer from the time gave a keynote, and he was talking about, and basically before he ended up doing the Batman soundtrack, which we'll talk about some more later, Prince was working on basically a house album. I think that would have been the original Rave Onto the Joy Fantastic. And that ended up kind of turning into Batman. So that's one of those records that I hope is in the vault in a condition that we can hear it, because that was really intriguing to me that Prince would have done a whole album around, you know, he did house influences obviously here and there. He did a lot of house remixes, especially in the late 80s, early 90s. And then, there, you know, there's plenty of influence on the final Batman album, but I'd really like to hear his version of what a house album would be.
Yeah, no kidding. And that was something that I really enjoyed about that story in particular, is realizing some of these influences that were front and center in some Prince songs that I knew really well. Like, I love the Batman soundtrack. I've been listening to it since it was one of the first Prince albums I got into, I think right after Purple Rain. But, you know, I was coming at it as a middle schooler from a purely like a rock context.
Right.
Now to sort of time travel right back to the same spot and hear the music again, but realize like, oh no, this isn't just like a beat that he's playing. This is a house beat, because by the time he's recording in 1988, house music is all over the clubs, you know? And so not only learning more about house, but seeing the influences that I already knew were in Prince without necessarily, you know, spotting them before in the music. Just having that greater context, I do think, helps me appreciate the music more.
Yeah.
You can dance if you want to. All the critics love you in New York. You don't have to keep the beat. They'll still think it's neat in New York.
So let's talk about the second piece, which is basically a review of the 1999 Super Deluxe. This feels like it might be something that you had published, you know, elsewhere.
Yeah, this was originally written for Vibe magazine back in 2019, I believe, mm-hmm. when the reissue came out. I ended up working on this right around the time I was wrapping up the House story. They were both right. tied to the reissue. And so I really enjoyed working on this as a case to sort of explain the remaster and why that made a big difference in terms of upgrading the sound, and then talking about the, you know, wealth of B-sides and unreleased stuff that was attached, and then really sort of making more explicit the case of, like, this is an important album because you can hear it everywhere still. Mm-hmm. You know, and kind of really explicitly making that connection was really exciting for me to be able to do that.
I like how you're connecting the dots. And just kind of anecdotally, it feels to me like 1999 has really kind of, I mean, I think Purple Rain is still probably the king in terms of Prince's canonization, but I've seen a lot of gains from 1999 lately. This feels like an album that is relevant to contemporary music.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, when people talk about stuff that sounds so clearly like Prince, I mean, I think for a lot of people, it comes back to, like, the sound of the Lynn drum and a lot of the keyboards that are on there. And really, he doesn't have that too much, or at least not as, like, consistently anywhere else besides 1999 and then scattered throughout Purple Rain. But, you know, that's where you see a lot more of the revolution coming in. So I think, you know, when people jump to, oh, this sounds like Prince, I think that they're really talking about 1999 most of the time. And I don't blame them. I mean, again, you can really hear some of those beats and the ways the keyboards are used. Like, you can see that all over. I think it's obviously been deconstructed and reconstructed and remade, and there's all these other influences in the mix, but I think 1999 is probably the one that's closest to what you can hear today.
And then we have What If Purple Rain Was a Double Album, which I always think these are fun. I think this is kind of a music lover's pastime in general, but I see this a lot among Prince fans, like coming up with alternate track lists. You know, what if this album was a little bit different? What if Prince put out an album in 1983 instead of working on Purple Rain all that year? So these are always fun to see. And I think a lot of the time people end up, it turns into arguments, but I think it's just fun to see these, like, different takes on, because he was always producing so much music at any given time that you can easily make up a lot of different albums that could have just from different configurations of the tracks that he was recording.
Oh, totally. And especially someone like him, you know, I feel like sometimes you see it in reverse. You know, people talk about, like, oh, could you narrow down the White Album to right. one album or something like that? Or there's that, to use another Beatles example, there's that great scene in Boyhood where Ethan Hawke's character has put together, like, a post, I think, like, a 1971 Beatles album using all their solo recordings, you know, he calls it the Black Album. You know, when you've got artists like that, or somebody like Prince, who just, like, has so much stuff to pick through, and especially a lot of unreleased things or alternate mixes and B-sides and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it's probably the equivalent of, you know, people sitting around talking about, like, oh, what if so-and-so didn't fumble that? Like, who would have won that year? Things right. like that. You can tell I'm not usually parts of these really sports oriented conversations, yeah. but, you know, like, it's that same sort of impulse, I think. And yeah, for this one in my head, as I was writing, I was like, this one is the bloggiest. but I had this playlist that I'd made of, like, I really wanted to kind of find the highlights of the reissue, because there's a lot of stuff mixed in there that, you know, like I talked about, the extended Computer Blue was a legendary sort of unreleased thing, and then here it was in a relatively strong condition that you
right.
could just throw it in the track list with the rest of the album and see how it changes. And so I wanted to mix in some of that stuff, some of the B-sides that, you know, I think a lot of it dates back to, again, me being in like eighth grade and hearing about like, oh yeah, there were B-sides on the records, but like you couldn't get the B-sides anywhere because they weren't on the CD.
Right.
And they weren't digital, you know, so like they were kind of lost to me for a time. So I'm still sort of like, wow, it's crazy that, you know, nowadays this isn't just like in the album or whatever.
yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily better. I think that's sort of how it ends up for me is like, look, you know, like I'm not, who am I to really tweak this? But I do think it's sort of, you can kind of extend the whole mood of it by throwing in a lot of the unreleased things or like the extended cuts from the 12-inch singles, stuff like that. And I think if you've listened to Purple Rain as much as I have, it's good to kind of mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Do you have like a alternate album cut or like a track list tweak, you know, that you go back to or that you've come up with that
you know,
you're really proud of?
So I actually put one together that was kind of similar to this unexpectedly. I had a patron and also a friend. She wanted me to imagine what if Purple Rain didn't happen when it happened, you know? So the way that I interpreted that was Prince goes, he keeps going down the path he was going with 1999, which was these big sprawling, you know, kind of psychosexual, sort of arty double albums, dancey, less of that Revolution influence. So I put together, it would have been two discs, and it was, so like When Doves Cry isn't on it, because that was written for Purple Rain. Purple Rain obviously gotcha. Isn't on it. In this universe, Prince gave Purple Rain to Stevie Nicks, like he, you know,
nice.
supposedly did, or at one point offered it to her. And it's just like, it's this stuff that is kind of darker from that period, like Possessed, like Love and Sex is on there. The of course, I mean, the long version of Computer like, Blue.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, you think about if he had kept Jungle Love and The Bird for himself,
yeah.
or, you know, wrestled them for Morris. I don't know exactly how those ones were written. You know, and then same thing with like, if Sex Shooter was on a Prince album with
right.
a female vocalist on it or whatever, you definitely could cook up here's a double album, but it's way more like long dance tracks. You know, it doesn't have nearly as much of like the rock feel to it. Yeah, that's a good experiment. I'm going to have to check that out. If you've got it posted somewhere, I would love to dabble with that one.
Yeah, sure. I'll send it to you. Yeah, but it's fun because it you know, this could be a good exercise, like a good critical exercise, because you can kind of see like what defined the album by what it wasn't. And one of the things that made Purple Rain stand out was the fact that he very deliberately did not do another double album after 1999. Everything
right.
is paired back. He could have easily done 1999 too with mm-hmm. a lot of the same songs. And it probably would have been successful also, but it maybe wouldn't have had as enormous a success as it did, because Purple Rain just like paired everything back to the purest, you know, version of that era of Prince. It's just
right.
45 minutes. And there's a little weird stuff, but not quite so, you know, like he holds back on Computer Blue, you know, because that long version is something else, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it could be really interesting to see like, okay, this isn't what he did, but seeing the path that was not taken can sometimes make the path that was taken kind of come into sharper focus.
Totally. And again, with somebody like Prince, you know, you can do that because he wrote so much stuff. There's so much documentation of the editing process that he went through. And then especially with someone like him, there are full albums that we know he had like put together and then didn't put out, you know, like you look at the Black Album or you look at Camille or all the different iterations that, you know, Dream Factory or Crystal Ball went through and stuff. There's this kind of like armchair quarterbacking is like not that far off from like, I'm sure the process he was going through, like, all right, all these fucking songs, like, what do I do with them?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I've even heard that like, I mean, there's a quasi heated debate over whether Dream Factory was a real album, because, you know, it's often thought of as, oh, this was the precursor to Sign of the Times. When the Revolution broke up, he scrapped Dream Factory and then it turned into Crystal Ball and then it turned into Sign of the Times. But I know a lot of people that are kind of that are sort of like Dream Factory truthers. And it's just like, actually Dream Factory, that was just some songs that he put on a tape basically so he could listen to in the car, and he never took it seriously as an album.
Gotcha.
I don't know what is the truth, but I find either scenario to be equally plausible, because like you said, he had so much music that he was constantly kind of putting them in conversation with each other and like, well, maybe this will work. Maybe this, and inevitably a lot of those ideas never came to fruition.
Yeah, at this point, we've already talked about what, like a half dozen of these like potential possible LPs that might have could have existed. And this is all just from like 6 years of his career, maybe.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot to dig through. It's a rewarding ongoing process. And it's also crazy for me to think about sometimes, like, again, I'm coming at this from sort of a skewed angle, to have actually been there as these records were coming out, or you were hearing the singles or whatever, must have been bananas. You know, like I'm still kind of getting a hold of it, looking at it from all these different angles, you know, years and years beyond the things were happening. But like to be out and about in 1984 and then hear When Doves Cry for the first time, I like cannot imagine.
Right. So next up, we have Nothing Compares to You, which I'm guessing was written when the Prince version came out to promote originals. Is this another one that you published outside of the book?
Yeah, this one definitely had some revisions from the first version. But yeah, I published it on Passion of the Weiss or POW, which is a great music blog run by Jeff Weiss, who's a really great music journalist, also a Prince diehard fan. He saw him like 6 or 7 times, including the Coachella set, which he said was kind of a big eye opener for him. So I froth with rage whenever we talk about this. But yeah, so he definitely was interested in running some Prince stuff whenever I was interested in talking about it. And so, yeah, this was tied to the, you know, original release of Prince's version of the song. But I kind of wanted to get into the sort of circular path that we even got to of it
right
out from the family to Sinead O'Connor to back to Prince all over again. And I think Nothing Compares to You was really interesting to talk about because I think maybe more than any of his other songs, at least from that 80s period, I after listening to it so much, I really started to see it as sort of a heir to Purple Rain, the song specifically, in the way that you were alluding to, that, you know, it's more of a rock song that you could have someone like Stevie Nicks or Sinead O'Connor sing it, you know, but it fits in between a lot of different genres. Like, and you saw that after he passed, a lot of people covered it and people you didn't expect. I believe Chris Stapleton did a great version of it. You know,
yeah,
so
Chris Cornell. So, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So seeing it, you can literally hear the song played across all these different genres by these people who work in all these other spaces. But I think it's interesting that he had this song that, much like Purple Rain, was really adaptable to all these other contexts. And weirdly enough, like that was how more people knew that song, was in a covered context.
Right.
For a long, long time.
Probably my favorite part of this is I think I actually saw you tweet something about this just the other day. But part of my favorite is where you reference the way Sinead O'Connor's version was used in Girl Talk, which is also, you know, that's one of those songs. I mean, I grew up with Sinead O'Connor, so maybe this is like less so for me. But that post Girl Talk, probably my equivalent is, like, I can't hear Gimme Some Lovin' and not think about International Players Anthem, you know.
Oh,
so
totally.
It's like the way that he just like rewires those connections.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that tweet being included, for one, I was like very excited to like cite the tweet semi-academically.
Right.
But I think that's also part of the origin of like, I originally wrote that for just kind of like a more casual, you know, bloggier setting, and I wanted to preserve that. But yeah, you know, I think that's also in some ways, like, not to get too high-minded about it, but a little bit reminder of like the context that I was coming at this music in is different than some other people. Right. And yeah, so as a result, like, I don't know the Sinead O'Connor version very well, but I do recognize it, like, pitched up a little bit and with the "I was getting some head, getting some head," like, laid over it by Girl Talk. And so for me, again, like, I knew of this song, but I didn't really know it super well until the Prince version came out. And I was kind of like, oh, let me see what this is all about. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, I think that, like, I was happy to be able to include that. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, like, another interesting pathway that, you know, music can take these different routes is, you know, never mind the fact that the song came out in 1990. I didn't really know it until 2010, and only because it was mashed up with a bunch of other things by Girl
right.
Talk, you know.
It's an interesting thing to think about because, you know, like I said, I was six when Sinead O'Connor's version, so that was like the definitive quote unquote version to me, because I wasn't old enough to hear The Family, you know, in 85. So I grew up with
heard The Family in 85,
right?
Way.
Right, like, yeah, I was old enough and nobody bought it. Yeah.
Sorry to The Family if you have yeah. to hear this.
So it's super interesting that coming of age kind of later, you almost, like, for you, the definitive version is probably the Prince one that came out.
But again, I had heard it from a lot of tributes in 2016, too. So it's, I don't know, I really enjoy sort of the way the mind kind of boggles thinking about some of the timelines of this stuff. You know, my personal timeline against the way some of this music came out.
Right.
You know, again, for me, it's a little bit selfish, but I sort of mapped some of this stuff out in the process of putting this book together. So I really enjoy having that all in one place.
So tell me about the Madhouse piece.
That story was originally written for the editorial arm of Vinyl Me Please, which is the vinyl subscription service.
Oh, I think I read that. I feel like I read it without knowing it was you. And I apparently forgot because I read it again in the book and I didn't make that connection. But yeah.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago. And that one in particular is close to my heart. It was one of the first freelance stories I'd ever written. I basically mm-hmm. cold messaged the editor at the time, because he was tweeting about, hey, pitch me things, and just went for it based on this pitch. And it worked out really great for me because I had sort of had the really organic experience of going to a record fair that was held at Pitchfork Festival one summer and, like, flipping mm-hmm. through the boxes, seeing some stuff. I don't remember if it was labeled as tied to Prince or if I pulled it out and someone running the show pointed that out to me or whatever. But, you know, I just kind of spontaneously found the two Madhouse albums and brought them home and enjoyed them in the context of where they were and started learning about them and kind of realizing, oh, this is a kind of weird thing to find, but I'm happy to have it. So in the process of trying to learn more about it, I realized, oh, this is something that not a lot of people know about, but it is a lot more accessible than it used to be.
Because right.
you can go on YouTube or whatever. And I think it's also interesting now in the scope of where the music went from there with Madhouse and things mm-hmm. like that. So, yeah, I was really happy to be able to write something that was focused on, like, the physical product of, you know, finding these records, but then also getting to delve into what was going on at the time around Sign of the Times and some of those other sessions. You know, that's the closest I've gotten to writing specifically about Sign of the Times, which on most days I'd probably say is my favorite. So it was nice to kind of come at that at sort of a different angle and sort of compare it to what Leeds was doing for Prince in these other scenarios and what impact the Madhouse LPs had, because they end up being relatively significant in other ways to people like Questlove and D'Angelo. You know, so not only talking about, hey, here's this Prince project you probably haven't heard about, but also pointing out, like, these sorts of Prince projects then became like a secret word of mouth phenomenon for the people who are really tuned in. You know, they still are, I think, in some ways, but mm-hmm. they're a little bit more accessible. You know, it's the times have changed technologically, but I think it was important to call out, like, there were people who knew what this stuff was, even if the marketing was pretty misleading, and there were people who paid attention to it. And you know, it's worth checking out. I think I wouldn't say the Madhouse albums are my favorite by any means, but they are interesting. And again, if you're a big Prince fan who happens to know like the big hit from Sign of the Times, like it's probably worth checking out this weird jazz fusion album he did at the same era that a lot of sounds like kind of like Weather Channel music or like Mario Kart music to me with today's ears.
I'm sure there's some hardcore Madhouse fans who would take issue, but I do think it's you know, it's a fair criticism to make of Prince's jazz stuff that it was a little on the smooth side, you know? So I think the coming at it from that angle is interesting. Like, you know, what does a Prince jazz album mean?
Oh, I got a live one here.
So we kind of talked about this a little bit before. If you got to go with a smile. This was one of the more interesting pieces to me. This is, like you said, a personal narrative, and it kind of works as the center point of everything that you're talking about. It's the hardest one to describe because, right, it's talking about some things that happened in your life right around the time that Prince died. It's also talking about the Batman album. I think you could do a better job of explaining it than I could for sure. So why don't you talk?
I'm glad you're a little bit puzzled by it. at least puzzled how to describe it, because I think, you know, this is a story that I had bouncing around my head for a while.
Right.
It's been 5 years since the events that are mostly described within it. But I didn't know where to publish it or how to even like describe it to people that might publish it. And so a big part of this book's existence is to have a place for this piece in particular and a couple of the other like originally written ones. But yeah, I do feel like this one is in some ways the centerpiece because it's sort of a personal essay, but it also, for a good chunk of it, is kind of just a review of the Batman soundtrack, but with the context around it of the Batman soundtrack and its importance to me. It's also like kind of grim and about mortality, which I know we're discussing a little bit later, but it really, to I guess the 10,000 foot view of it, is I was in a really bad car accident along with my girlfriend and her dad. Everybody's okay, but 2016, early April, we were all in the ICU and recuperating for months and months afterwards and severely doped up on painkillers. 2 or 3 weeks go by and then Prince dies and it turns out it's an overdose of opioids and, you know, all sorts of unsavory details emerge from there. But it was this weird sort of historical overlap of I was already a huge Prince fan. And I remember like being in a recovery room in a hospital bed and seeing on my phone, like one person found dead at Paisley Park and thinking, like, oh no, who could this be? You know, besides the obvious. And then I also get into the kind of connection between Prince and Batman and me. Like I always grew up a big comic book fan. My dad's a huge comic book fan. So especially as I was recovering from this accident, I was like getting a lot of Batman stuff from family and friends, like here's a Batman poster to put up in your hospital room. And here's, you know, like we're bringing you comic books. And I was also watching a lot of Batman movies and the animated stuff. A, I was on a lot of drugs. B, it was comforting. You know, it was like the stuff I wanted to, you know, sit down and like all I could do was sit down. But, you know, like that was what I was doing, was the comfort food I was retreating to.
Right.
Also then overlapped with Prince's career in this interesting way. And so I don't know that there's necessarily like a strong conclusion coming out of the piece besides just sort of the fact that these things do overlap to my mind. And I hope the connections sort of become clear in the process of reading it. But it was also just fun. There were parts of it, too, that I wanted to write about. Like, I wanted to talk about how, like, Prince's vision of Batman is, like, pretty coherent.
Right.
But really unique. You know, like, I wanted to talk about that stuff. But I also couldn't talk about that without also explaining my ties to Prince and to Batman and, you know, the overlap there. So I don't think I've made it any clearer for anyone who's listening and hasn't read it. But I hope you do read it. I think, again, it's sort of the centerpiece in some ways. And I don't think it's a piece that I could have really gotten published anywhere else but I'm happy that it's out there. And I think it felt good to sort of articulate all the stuff that was in it. Like I said, I'd sort of been wanting to find a place for a story like that.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things, is that you're pulling together all of these very disparate threads, and it does work. And I think part of the reason why it works is because it's sort of fever dream like, you know, and so you're kind of able to pull together these different things. But there's a lot of just weird threads in Prince's life. You know, the fact that one of the first songs he played on the piano was the Neil Hefti Batman theme from the 1966 show. And then, you know, that was also one of the last things he played, because he would play it in his concerts on the piano and a microphone tour. And I do see kind of I feel like Batman has been getting a reappraisal, the Batman soundtrack by Prince. Like, for the longest time, it was like, oh, that was his worst album of the 80s. You know, there was that famous scene in Shaun of the Dead where he's throwing records and, you know, he doesn't want to throw Purple Rain, but he'll throw the Batman soundtrack, you know. And so it got short shrift. But I feel like people, my generation and younger, are starting to kind of reclaim Batman a little bit, because yes, it's a goofy album, but it's also like, it's so bizarre. I mean, like, you look at the lyric sheet, and the song Scandalous is written from the perspective of Batman, not Bruce Wayne, Batman. This is canonically a song about Batman fucking. So I just think that, you know, people who grew up with Batman and who grew up with Prince, I think more of us are just enjoying the inherent absurdity of it, you know, and the fact that there's some good songs. Yeah. You know, Vicky Waiting is a really good song. I really enjoyed this piece.
Called that out about the Batman theme. Thank you. He it is weird. Like, he only played it a couple times ever. He talked about how it was in the first songs he learned, but I swear, I think he played it at his last show on that piano and a microphone tour, which is just weird. I think there's also this interesting connection. If you go back to the house story in the first chapter, I don't remember if it's Jesse Saunders or Vince Lawrence, but there's someone in there who talks about learning, I believe it was the intro to I Want to Be Your Lover, as one of the first songs that they learned on piano. You know, so there's kind of these echoes, I think, that kind of cross between, you know, these influences. And to bring it back to the Batman soundtrack specifically, I'm with you. There's a great article this week in the Number Ones, which is this column on Stereogum about number one hit songs. And they just did Bat Dance. And I think the assessment of Bat Dance was pretty good, in that Bat Dance itself is like a very weird mess.
Right.
But people got talking a lot about the various remixes that came out, where it's not just like several songs shoved together. It really is just like one coherent track. And then when you move beyond like the biggest hit that was clearly super gimmicky, some of those songs are some of my favorites. Like, I've been listening to it like crazy this week, and like The Future is incredible. Electric Chair is awesome. Vicky Waiting is, again, possibly one of my favorites of his. Like, those three in particular are so good. Lemon Crush is good in there. They're not all fantastic. You know, it's not like all killer, no filler, or some of the other ones, but like, it's very good. And I think in particular, I have no idea if this is even feasible with the legal mess that the Batman rights exist as.
But right.
I would love to get a reissue where, you know, we'd be able to hear not only like the B-sides in place, but maybe some of the other stuff that was scrapped, or like the longer versions of the segments of Bat Dance or whatever, because I do, you know, here we are like fan casting again, but you know, there is, I think, a better album mixed in with those sessions. And I think there's a good album right there to be appreciated, too. No doubt.
Yeah, I almost wonder if the weird legal situation with Prince is, from my understanding, is Sony has the rights to everything except for the soundtracks, which are retained by Warner. In a weird way, I almost wonder if that is going to make the chances of like a super deluxe Batman greater than they would be otherwise, because Warner only has four albums now that they can kind of sell. So I'll be curious. I'll buy it if no one else will. You know, I know that won't fly off the shelves quite like Sign of the Times, but I would definitely support that release.
Definitely. I think there's also a, you know, gray market super deluxe Batman out there that I haven't been able to find access to. But if anyone listening this knows what I'm talking about, it's probably like a huge Mega Drive file somewhere. But, you know, like, you can find me and send that to me. That would be cool. While we're waiting on the official version, of course.
Right.
I'm big on the Batman soundtrack for sure on its own. Like, I don't know if I necessarily like make that point super clear in the process of like talking about my own traumas and the inevitability of death. But yeah, like, the Batman soundtrack goes hard. Let me make that clear.
Burning liar, eternal fire, demon clever, promise forever, the curious trying always die.
Yeah, so then the next piece, this is also kind of, this felt almost like a bonus track to the last one, because you talk about while you're recuperating in the hospital, one of the first things you write is an obituary of Prince, and then you include that obituary next. So I thought that was a cool companion to the earlier piece. You get to actually see what you wrote.
Yeah, thank you. I was really happy when I started like looking at, okay, this is what I have written previously. These are the new things that I want to write. And then how am I going to lay this out? I was really happy to be able to like sort of preview it. As you mentioned, like in the previous story, I talk about writing this thing in my hospital bed, writing this obit, because again, at the time I was like, okay, nobody gets how big a deal this is, because everyone in college with me right now doesn't know anything about Prince. Let me write this. Like, I know I got hit by two cars a week and a half ago, but like, you need to let me write this thing. Which looking back, I'm like, why did I do that? That's insane. You know, what was I? But again, I was like, I have to write this because nobody else in this paper is going to. So part of me was like happy to have it there. But then I also think it's fun for me. Like, I definitely don't think it's the best written thing in the book, but it's also one of the first things I've written. I mean, it was for my college newspaper, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it wasn't even really when I was freelance writing. And so I was happy to have that included. And I think that also gave it a little bit more of a like an overarching narrative when you get the personal essay that's so specifically written by me about me, and then follow up with this in some ways like very impersonal thing that's, you know, an obituary written for kind of a general audience. But you have that context of, OK, when I wrote this and all this stuff, I think it adds, you know, a couple layers to it. So I'm glad that you thought that worked.
And then next we have, this is just a great title, Who is Hiding a Stoned Prince Story, which... Why don't you just tell me about this one?
Like, yeah, this was written for another piece for PAL. So this is originally written online, again, for a friend who is an editor who is indeed a Prince fan. But it started out really with Lady Cab Driver, and I kind of worked backwards from there because, you know, and this kind of goes to show, like, I did not know what I was getting into as, like, a maturing kid, like, getting into Prince, like, listening to Lady Cab Driver and like not knowing what that bubbling noise was for like a long time. That comes in, you know, like 5 minutes into the track, like in the breakdown and stuff. And like, it's a bong. I know that now. but, you know, being like 13, 14 and Googling, like, what is this noise that's happening on Lady Cab Driver? And there was like a large subsection of people who had these like very weird theories about like, oh, it's not a bong. It's like the sound of someone dying because right. They were killed after sex with the cat. I'm like, whoa. Like, there is like a lot of weird emotional psychosexual territory in these Prince songs. But like, it doesn't go that far.
Hold yeah.
This is especially hilarious in retrospect. Like, it's a fucking bong. Come on. So it kind of grew from this idea of like, okay, yes, like we know, generally speaking, like especially early on in his career during like that classic period, like Prince was generally not like into all sorts of drugs, especially right. The way you'd expect from like the era. There's really not a lot of documentation of him doing anything besides a couple of these examples that I rattle off throughout the story. And so there's obviously some intersections with drugs in his music specifically. Mm-hmm. Again, especially during that classic period that this story is kind of about, but it really kind of builds to like, okay, so here's the deal. Like, this is what we know about Prince. Despite all that, he's got this bong sound on Lady Cab Driver. What's up with that? Whose bong was it? Why did he include it? And again, also knowing some of the background of the people he was working with and things like that, it's like, who was it? What was going on? Who's getting high with Prince? Like, Wendy and Lisa were the people getting him into like the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that. You know, was it him and Morris Day? You know, like, we really don't know. And that's not something that'll probably ever be like addressed by any of the many Prince surrogates that talk about these things. But like, I want to know.
Right.
And that's really what it comes down to is like, you know, there are these other intersections, you know, where things are mentioned or whatever. It's usually pretty sort of, you know, thumbing your nose, pun intended, at drug users. But at least this one time, it's like, all right, who was hitting the bong with Prince in the studio or, you know, whatever the story is, I would love to know. I do think that's one of the ways that like some of his music is unique. You know, his music isn't all that druggy, except when it is. And then you're like, oh, what's up with that? Because, you know, it's not like he had some sort of Beatles Dr. Robert moment of getting turned on to all these different things, as far as we know. So it's kind of interesting that that does go unaddressed for a lot of his work. And then, you know, obviously tried to keep it focused on some of the early classic period stuff where, again, he does have these lyrical references that pop up. So if, again, if someone happens to read this book who knows the answers to these questions, like, please let me know. That's sort of the pipe dream, is that, you know, this gets to Lisa somehow and she can fill me in on like, yeah, you know, back in the day, like Minneapolis' stash was terrible, but, you know, whatever.
Drop it down. Don't stop it now. Get it now.
So yeah, then with the next piece we've got, this is kind of touching on what you were talking about way at the beginning of our conversation, of this kind of this period in the 2000s when Prince was, you know, pretty combative with his fans, especially on the internet. So you have this piece here about FUNK, which for those, this is one of those where it's like, this is a deep cut, right? Because it's like, I don't know how much people were paying attention, unless you were on Prince.org and Housequake and all of those. The whole story behind Prince's 2007 song FUNK, it's almost like a petty internet grievance story, you know, but it happens to be like a really good track.
So good. I would ask, like, did you know this song before reading about it? Not to like test you, but I am curious, because again, you're someone who's very in the know, but this song is in some ways kind of missing now. Like, you can't stream it. It's kind of disappeared.
Right. This was, I kind of faded in and out on Prince in the 2000s. So like, I was getting into him, you know, seriously right around the time of Musicology, which that lined up well, you know, that was like, now Prince is everywhere.
This is the comeback time for sure.
Right. And, you know, I followed along. And I was about to fall off in 2007, you know, because that was around Planet Earth, which is an album that I've definitely softened on it. You know, I like it more now than I did at the time. I think just in general, I'm a lot softer on a lot of Prince's stuff now than I was when he was here. And it didn't, you know, his music felt like it was always going to be there, you know. So now that it's sort of a more precious commodity, I tend to be a lot less critical of it. But this is kind of toward the tail end of my resurgence of interest in Prince, that particular iteration of it. So I remember when it came out, I wasn't embroiled in the, you know, I wasn't involved in the fan community on that level, but I was like, you know, reading lurking on forums and seeing people talk about it. And the funniest thing to me is that it's aimed at his fans, and it's like pretty, you know, he doesn't really pull any punches, but people also loved it. Like, it felt like one of the more well-received Prince tracks from that time.
Yeah, it cracks me up. And, you know, again, I think this is one of those moments where, like, my timeline is a little bit different. Like, I was just becoming a fan of Prince, period. So I remember seeing, like, this new song pop up on iTunes, and I was like, oh, great, here's my 99 cents. So I didn't really understand any of the context for, you know, a decade or so, but I just really liked this one random single he put out that then kind of disappeared. But it's this like 7.5 minute song with like these really heavy funk riffs, and it like goes all these different places. It's got kind of this Camille vocal to it, but it's kind of like smack talking. And the background is that it was aimed at a coalition of his fans who were pushing back on his attempts to control his image and shut down things like, oh, you've got a bumper sticker on your car with the love symbol, take that photo down. Like, your whole website has to come down. Like, he was going nuts on the internet, like doing all these cease and desist stuff. So these groups of fans got together to be like, hey, stop doing this. And so his response was to put out this like basically like 7.5 minute sort of diss track. aimed at these people, but it's a really good song. And, you know, that's sort of like kind of the central irony of it is like, oh, can you imagine if like you piss off Prince so much that he like not only releases a new song, but like writes a song about like these annoying little fans I have or whatever.
Right.
But I also wanted to kind of put down that history because it's not really, you know, there's writing of it from 2007, you know, on these ancient looking web pages, but it's not really written down anywhere sort of cohesively. And the song is also kind of hard to find. I mean, you know, again, like if you want to hear it, I can send it to you. If you're listening to this and you haven't heard it, but like, I don't think it's on YouTube. You know, it's not in the stuff that's currently streaming.
Right.
And at the time, I think it disappeared too. You know, like I think it was only available for like a day or two and it made headlines, but then it wasn't pushed as a single or anything like that. But which kind of surprises me because again, it was super good. And coming back to it in recent years, this is sort of like the same thing that happened to me with some of these house influence tracks is coming back with a way wider appreciation of some of Prince's influences and hearing this song that's relatively new, late in his career, but has all these influences of P-Funk and Sly Stone and some of these like pre-80s sounds that also I think you can hear in the new Welcome to America album. It's, it was recorded a few years before those sessions, but I think you can hear some of that same kind of like 70s funk energy as a commonality between those projects. And so, yeah, this is sort of the one piece in the book that's like very explicitly about like kind of late career Prince, in part because there's a big chunk of his career in the middle. Like, I don't know his 90s stuff nearly as well until really we hit like that Musicology sort of pop comeback period.
Right.
That's still sort of an unknown, you know, section of his career for me. And I've kind of done that deliberately. Like, I want to have some stuff to keep getting into. And that's not really a problem with him. But yeah, it's just like a really good song. And again, I wanted to kind of log it and also tie it into this idea of what it means to be a Prince fan. And in some ways, they're sort of they were a little bit ahead of the curve on this idea of like, you know, you look at somebody's Twitter today, somebody's famous, got all these people underneath that are just saying horrendous things about like, hit me with a truck, like, blah, 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 blah. Like, I do think like you can sense some of that impulse in like all these Prince, you know, message board member diehards who, you know, are like, hey, man, like, we're really fans of your work. Like, please don't shut down our websites. You know, they get like this 8-minute track and it's sort of like, oh, my God, like, thank you for insult. You know, I imagine I would feel kind of the same way. You know, I if I was a little bit older, I imagine I might have been on some of those boards, too. So, yeah, I was happy to kind of tie that into all these other fans that are sort of accounted for in the course of the book. It's sometimes they mobilize, weirdly enough.
Right. I think it also brings up something that I was not aware of until after Prince was gone, was how weirdly accessible he was, you know, like. It's funny to think about because his persona is so like, you know, like Chappelle's Show coming out of the dry ice. Like he just seems otherworldly. But at the same time, he was also just like on Twitter for a while, you know, talking to people. You could go to his house, which is something that you talked about in the Batman piece. You talked about going to Paisley Park. What was it, like 2013, somewhere around there?
2014, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great example. Like he just tweeted from, I think it was the Third Eye Girl account he was running at the time. He tweeted about like, hey, party at Paisley Park tonight. And so I went, you know. It was weird. Like that's a lot of stuff. I think anything you read about Prince, like there's always a lot of lingering questions. I think he's sort of Citizen Kane-y in that way. But I think in particular, the way he controlled access to like himself and his music was never super clear or coherent. I mean, he in general really wanted to have control over the way his stuff came out, but there's this weird sort of push and pull, especially with the internet, where like in the late 90s, he's really into the internet and is putting stuff out there for fans exclusively before a lot of other people are, especially like established superstars like him from, you know, several artistic generations ago. But then a few years later, like it's a fight to get his stuff on iTunes and he's like cracking down on his image all over the place. And then he was not on streaming for a long time. It was a big deal when he did come to Tidal exclusively, because again, it was, you know, the most artist friendly and things like that, you know, and that's again, only in like the last sort of 12, 15 years of his life. Obviously before that, you've got all the Warner Brothers fights and back and forth and him writing Slave on his face and stuff like that. You know, it's clear that he always wanted to have control of his stuff, but his sort of preferences from there kind of shifted as the music industry changed around him.
So tell me about this last piece is about D'Angelo and Prince. And I thought it was a good way to end the book, because you talk about D'Angelo's version of Sometimes It Snows in April, which was probably, I didn't watch every tribute to Prince after he died, but I did made sure to watch that because it was D'Angelo. And I think it was definitely one of the most, if not the most, affecting. So I thought this was a good note to end the book on.
Yeah, this is another one that I had written specifically for this book. I wanted to start with the two Prince covers that he's done. He also covered She's Always in My Hair in the late 90s originally, and it's a really good cover. And he kept it in his sets when he came back in 2014 after this, you know, really mythically long absence from the music industry and public life. He was still doing She's Always in My Hair in his comeback tour, 2014, 2015, and stuff like that. So I wanted to talk about that song and sort of D'Angelo's relationship with Prince, but then in particular talk about sort of the other Prince cover that he does, which as far as I know is just the one time, but this really beautiful performance on, I think it was Jimmy Fallon's show, of Sometimes It Snows in April, I swear, like 2 or 3 days after Prince died, and he's got two backing vocalists and it's just him at the piano otherwise. And it's a really great performance. It's very moving, especially with sort of the understanding that I had, and I think there's a lot of sort of examples given in the story, but he just is a huge Prince fan and someone who looks up to Prince in a artistic way that's very visible and that he is not shy about shouting out throughout his career. In the process of researching this, I'm also a huge D'Angelo fan, but it's sort of an opposite status of the way Prince operates, because for a long time, the issue with D'Angelo is just, can we have some more music, please?
Right.
He is so not prolific in the way that Prince was, which I think is sort of an interesting point of contrast. But I love Voodoo's, probably one of my favorite albums ever. His other two albums are fantastic. I mean, you know, the thing about him taking his sweet time is it's always really good when he does. So love D'Angelo. And I was really excited to kind of dive deeper into the connections between him and Prince. So in the process of doing some of this research, I found some great quotes that I hadn't seen before. When he was interviewed for Rolling Stone right around the time Voodoo came out, which if people aren't familiar, it's the album with Untitled on it, which is most famous for the impossibly sexy video of him singing like directly to the camera. Fantastic album. The song itself is good. The video is great. He's an incredible performer, all this stuff. But in this interview that he's doing right around the time of this album coming out, it's him and Questlove talking to the interviewer, explaining how this is basically our audition tape for Prince. Like, we listened to a ton of classics, you know, Sly Stone, James Brown. We were like really digging into all the, they call them Yodas, all their Yodas of popular music and funk that we're trying to channel. But really, if we could work with Prince after doing this, that would be really cool. You know, I don't remember which one of them says something like, I wouldn't even have to put my name on it, or I could use a different name, like whatever. We just want to work with Prince. And, you know, I don't think that, I think you can obviously hear some of Prince's influence coming through, but to hear him say so deliberately, like, yes, I want to work with Prince, I want to be with Prince, it so much reinforces this already emotional performance he gives, you know, a few days after his death, of this very melancholy and grieving song that Prince had already sort of written about his own death, or at least a fictional character's death that was inspired by him. You know, it just, it's already such a great performance, but I think with the literal like decades that go back from that performance of like where the song came from and D'Angelo's approach to it and his love for Parade and all this stuff that's, you know, you're able to connect these dots. I think, you know, again, it's a great story of Prince influencing a musician, but it's also just about a big Prince fan. I think if there's any sort of connecting theme that runs through the book, that might be it. Other than Prince itself, is just the way that a lot of other people are Prince fans and they can have all these other ripple effects too. Without sort of realizing it, that's definitely sort of something that's cohered around the stories in the book, which I don't think should be a surprise because I myself am one of these diehard fans. And I think it's encouraging for someone too, you know, like the idea of, you know, you might not be able to surpass your idols, but you can do something different to the point that you're someone else's version of them. You know, like D'Angelo was close to Prince for some people and still is for some people, you know. And I think that's a powerful, powerful message.
Maybe he's found the answer to all the April snow. Maybe one day I'll see my Tracy again. Sometimes it snows in April. Sometimes it feels so bad, so bad. Sometimes I wish life was never ending and all good things they say never last. All good things they say never last. Love is love till it's past.
So, yeah, that's all of the pieces in the book.
Thank you for letting me do like a director's commentary every story here. I really appreciate it again. Like, I knew I'd be able to kind of rattle off some references and, you know, we'd be able to go deep on some of this stuff. So I really appreciate you letting me run them down.
Yeah, for sure. We were saying before we started recording, you know, I was saying that this is one of my favorite genres of Prince book. It reminds me, there was a book by Scott Woods, a writer that I really like and a friend of the show. He wrote a book a while back that was, you know, similar, just like a collection of his own writing about Prince. And I enjoy the idiosyncrasies of that. You know, it's not like, oh, this is a biography, this is a sessionography, or it's not all the same kind of criticism. It's really just like one writer's take on an artist that they're a big fan of. And I think that it can be, it's just fun to read. It's fun to read somebody else. It's like having a conversation like this, you know,
book form. Happy to hear that, really.
So yeah, I really enjoy the book. I feel like anybody listening to this will probably enjoy it. I'm looking forward to getting my physical copy because I do want to put in a plug for the design. It looks beautiful from what I've seen of it, just colorful, and the art is it's by your girlfriend, right?
Yeah, I'm holding it aloft on the other side of the Skype call, which you guys obviously can't see, but yeah, the physical copy is really, really exciting. That's again another reason that I was happy to kind of collect all this in one place, was to then turn it over to make me look good with the design. But yes, my girlfriend Mary, who is again, sort of in the book as well, because she was in that same car accident I was.
Right.
She's also a Prince fan, and she's a great artist. So we collaborated on this project. She has several different illustrations throughout. There's a great portrait of D'Angelo, a portrait of Prince. The story about Batman and the car accident has a great illustration of the Purple Rain motorcycle. And then on the next page, an illustration of the car we were wrecked in. So it's really great art in there. And then I worked with this design studio out of Cincinnati, Ohio, called Cereal Box Studio. Eric and Julia there did some great work with designing it to fit the 7x7 45 format. And so the cover has this really great wraparound purplish artwork on it. of the flowers from the Purple Rain era, but it looks like you're holding a 45 in your hands with like the title on the label and stuff like that. So it's I'm really happy to have everything in one place. It's funny, I initially brought it to this publishing place as like, oh, let's do like quick and dirty, like black and white, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, all right, well, we're gonna do this, like, let's do it up. So all the credit goes to those three for like making it look so good and hold together. And I'm super appreciative of the people who have pre-ordered a copy already, because I think the cover itself looks good, but to see it sight unseen and then get to, I think, get the physical copy and read it all the way through with the art, I think it's gonna go up several notches. So especially for someone like you who's already read the text but not quite gotten the full experience. So yeah, I'm really excited, and it's nice. This is the first time I've had sort of a collection of my work. I mostly operate freelance, like I said, so it's cool to be able to look back and see, oh, I've got a, you know, got a little body of work here now, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I, not to put you on the spot, but I thought to ask you, you know, one last question. I thought I would ask what your take on Welcome to America is. Have you had a chance? It sounds like you've listened to it because you mentioned
Yeah,
it.
Definitely. Yes, I want to give a shout out to my man, Dan Bromf, who reviewed it for Pitchfork.
Yeah, I read that.
I was trying to review for Pitchfork, and they picked up his pitch, and he did great. So I was like happy to see someone I know crush it and do a good review of it. That said, I don't know if I entirely agree with the Pitchfork review. I think it's something I'm going to need to sit with. I like it. I think in my mind, it seems to me as sort of the 70s album he didn't get to make, you know, like if he had been recording for a couple of years by the time it was 1974, you know, would he have made this album without any drum machines or keyboards or anything like that and sort of a stripped down kind of soulful sound. So I like it. I like kind of hearing the range of topics. You know, he definitely has some more pointed lyrics about the record industry and race in America and things like that. But at the same time, like, I've only listened to it a couple times in the past week. I mean, I've been busy, but it's also like not something I'm leaping to right away. And I think it's definitely plagued by some of the problems that the albums that he did release at that time have, where like it just, the sound of it, it's very dry and kind of plain, and it just doesn't seem to really kind of have that, some of the classic like reverb and bounce to it that you'd expect to hear. I think the worst example of this is that Hot Summer, which I know they put out as a single.
Right.
But I just, it doesn't sound good to me. It sounds like super generic, and especially the way it's like recorded and produced, like does not help really inject any life into it, which is fine. Like lots of Prince albums come out with some like not so great tracks. So I'm happy it's out. I think it's really making me want to go back to kind of reevaluate some of the other albums of that period. Like I remember buying Planet Earth when it came out. Right. I bought the Minneapolis Sound and Lotus Flower box set or whatever when that came out. You know, I pirated 2010 because it didn't come out in the US, but everybody in the UK got a copy for free or whatever. So, you know, like I remember those albums coming out and they were all, you know, uneven, but had some highlights in it. So I think it's making me want to go back and kind of re-listen to the whole thing. But, you know, like we were talking about earlier, like it leaves this unanswered question of like, okay, if he had this album finished, like, why hold back? Like, it's right. Clearly at least on par with the other stuff that was out at the time. So, you know, I don't quite follow. I don't follow that.
Yeah. My whole thing at this point is just that everything that I need out of him, he done by 1988. You know, everything past then is like bonus to me. You know, I feel like if you do 1999, Purple Rain, Parade, Sign of the Times, Love Sexy, I don't give a shit like what you do for the rest of your life. You've earned, like you can retire, you know? So it's like everything is just gravy. I enjoy it. I like a lot of the songs. I like that 70s feel. Is it his greatest album since Sign of the Times? No, but it doesn't need to be. Like to me, it's all just extra now. And right. So I think of everything that comes out as being like, this is amazing that that Prince is still putting out music, even though he died 5 years ago, you know?
Right,
and
right.
So that's my take on it. But
and I think too, it's a little bit different for us as someone who knows his catalog so well. And again, knows how much stuff he was writing in that classic period. And, you know, the idea of he doesn't quite have another 1999 buried in the unreleased stuff, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's close. I think there's also the idea of like, well, he had so much stuff that was so good during his classic period that, you know, it almost makes you wonder, like, he could have stretched all that stuff out across the following 20 years. Right. You know, he didn't want to do that, which makes him a lot more interesting than, you know, I'm sure many other successful musicians who would be like, yeah, I'm working off the old ones, working off the classics or whatever. But I think you're right. Like, it's very easy when you look just at the amount of stuff he put out in the highest of high times. Like, yeah, I mean, who cares that he released a bunch of weird, bad, misshapen albums from there? Like, Stones did that.
Yeah, right.
Like, it, I think it happens to anybody who keeps working. And I think, you know, it's very rare to be someone like D'Angelo who takes their sweet time putting stuff out and is always impeccably good. The further I get away from, I guess, Prince being here to talk about this kind of stuff, the more I sort of come to understand and appreciate the fact that he did just keep putting stuff out and trying new things. You know, like, you go back and listen to the last couple albums, and I don't know that it's good per se, but, like, he's got electronic sounds on there. He's, like, doing a dubstep drop at one point. You know, he's, like, experimenting with stuff in a way that, again, you've got to respect, like, to twist it around a little bit. Like, the Stones don't do shit like that.
Right.
You
know? Right.
He made that point about U2, I think it was in the early 90s, of, like, look, I could do U2 songs, and they do their song great, but they can't do Housequake.
Right.
And I think about that a lot. I think that's it's a very sort of valid frame to understand his work in. It's like, he wanted to keep trying new stuff and experimenting with it. And, like, if it doesn't always land, like, that's what happens when you keep trying new stuff. I'm glad that it's out there and we're getting to hear more and more of those, you know, experiments as the vault unfolds, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking that curveball. And yeah, why don't you let us know where we can find you, where we can get the book, all of that.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, like, I'm putting out the book independently, so you can get it on jackreedy.com, which is my website. It's called Electric Word Life. So if you search for that, you should be able to find it. Maybe include my name in there just to be sure. But we printed up 200 copies for the first run. So I've pre-sold a bunch so far, so they're going to go kind of fast. But anyone who gets a chance to check it out, I'd really, really appreciate it. And I think it's definitely, as we mentioned, the target audience in some ways is the people who are tuning into a podcast like this. So much appreciate you, like I said, letting me do just sort of a director's commentary on this stuff. And let me geek out with you for an hour and a half here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks so much. I had fun. Thanks for coming.
Thank you once again to Jack Reedy. His book, Electric Word Life, Writing on Prince, 2016 to 2021, is still available as of this recording. You can order it on his website. And like I said, I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. He's a good writer, covers some really interesting topics that you don't really see in other Prince books. And it's an independently published. So I'm a big believer in supporting independent writers, independent publishers. So check it out. Limited edition. Get it while it's hot. And in the meantime, thank you for listening. Like always, I trying to get back to a regular schedule here. So if you haven't subscribed yet, subscribe. If you haven't left a review, leave a review. If you're so inclined, you want to rate the podcast, that would also be cool. But I mean, the bottom line is, thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon. Yeah.